WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Yugoslavia eclipsed what had been the national obsession, the presidential sex scandal. But this week, it was back in the news. A federal judge held President Clinton in contempt of court, saying he had willfully provided false testimony under oath about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky in the Paula Jones sexual misconduct lawsuit. And today, independent counsel Kenneth Starr urged a Senate panel not to renew the independent counsel law that authorizes the position. Journalist Michael Isikoff has covered the presidential sex scandal since Paula Jones' 1994 press conference, in which she alleged that the president sexually harassed her. Isikoff was the first reporter onto the Monica Lewinsky story. Now he's written a book about investigating the scandal called Uncovering Clinton. Isikoff was a reporter for The Washington Post from 1981 till 1994 when he joined Newsweek. He first heard about Monica Lewinsky through Linda Tripp. He told me how Tripp became his source.
In January of 1997, at the time that the Supreme Court was hearing arguments about whether the Paula Jones case should go forward, I received some information from one of the Jones lawyers, Joe Camerata, about a anonymous phone call he had gotten at just about that time involving another woman. He didn't know who the woman was, but there were a number of clues as to the identity of the other woman. The other woman claimed that something like what happened to Paula Jones had happened to her while she was in the White House, while she was working at the White House. I eventually, taking the clues and the tips from the anonymous phone call, figured out that this woman was most likely Kathleen Willey. I asked her for the names of any people who she had related this incident to at the time, and one of the women she mentioned was Linda Tripp.
The first time she offered to play you tape of her phone conversations with Monica Lewinsky, you declined to hear the tape. Why did you decline?
It was a very uncomfortable situation. I had been talking on and off to Tripp for months, first about the Willey incident, but she had made clear to me that the Willey incident was not the real story here. She thought there was a more serious story that was ongoing involving a young woman whose identity she was at that point not willing to divulge, but who was a former White House intern who was then working for another agency of the United States government and had been involved in an ongoing sexual relationship with the president. I certainly wanted to know a bit more, especially when she said that the relationship involved efforts by the president to placate her by finding her employment either within the federal government at other federal agencies or, as it later turned out, outside the government. I got invited in October of 1997 to attend a meeting at the apartment of Jonah Goldberg, the son of a New York literary agent, Lucianne Goldberg, who Tripp said was advising her about what to do about all this. And I attended the meeting and for the first time learned that Tripp had been secretly taping her conversations with Lewinsky. And that's when I first learned the name, Monica Lewinsky. I didn't know it until I went to the meeting. And I didn't know that there was any taping involved. Taping without somebody else's consent is not something that I, as a reporter, do. And given that Tripp informed me that she was, that her secret taping of this woman, Monica Lewinsky, was ongoing at that time, I did not want to become involved or enmeshed in that process. I was more than willing and quite eager to hear what Linda Tripp had to tell me about what Lewinsky had told her, but I did not want to participate even by extension in the taping of Monica Lewinsky and declined to listen to the tapes.
When did you change your mind about listening?
When I learned much later that Ken Starr, the independent counsel, had launched a secret criminal investigation of the president, and the tapes were the central evidence in this investigation. At that point, the taping by Tripp was completed was done. It was not an ongoing process, and that was the part that bothered me the most. But more importantly, at that point, I thought it was very important to hear what was on the tapes and what was the evidence in this investigation of the president.
At one point in your discussions with Linda Tripp, she suggested that she tried to steal the semen-stained dress and get it to you. Would you describe her plan?
Well, it was pretty unusual, to say the least. As I say, during this period of the fall of 1997, I was in touch with Tripp and, to a lesser extent, Lucianne Goldberg, sort of hearing what they had to say, but mainly working on other stories. And then one, as I describe in the book, one morning I receive a somewhat breathless call from a whispering Linda Tripp telling me that... she had been to Lewinsky's apartment the night before, and she had been shown this dress that Lewinsky had told her had the president's semen on it. And, she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, I think that's rather incredible. What else could one say under those circumstances?" And she said, "What do you think?" And I said, "About what?" I said, "Do you think I should take it?" And at that point, I was a bit startled and said, "And do what with it?" And she said, "Give it to you." And I paused and said, "And what would I do with it?" And she said, "Well, you could have it tested." And at this point, I sort of, took a deep breath and said, what is going on here?" I tried to impress upon her that... there really wasn't anything I could do with the dress, even if I were inclined to take it, which I would not have been because I was not about to become a party to theft. There would be no practical way for me to test it anyway. I didn't have a sample of the president's DNA. There wasn't anything I could do with that dress to prove the relationship between Lewinsky and the president. And I mostly just chalked it up as something rather a bizarre development and thought that Tripp was a bit strange, to say the least, in asking me about this, and sort of put it aside. And of course, months later, the dress returned in a rather significant way.
What were your thoughts about Linda Tripp as a source? On the one hand, she was giving you great information. On the other hand, she was secretly taping phone conversations with somebody who was ostensibly a friend. She was offering to steal that friend's dress and give it to you so that you could get it tested in a laboratory.
I thought that I was profoundly ambivalent about all this. You're right. I mean, I was... a reporter, and I was interested in her information because it seemed to me that it was potentially quite newsworthy. On the other hand, I did have a lot of doubts about what she was doing and about the role that I was playing, even in listening to what she had to say. But it was clear to me, or it became increasingly clear, that she saw me as the vehicle to get the story out. Now, there was a coincidence of interests here because if what she was telling me was true and if all of what she was telling me was true, I thought it said quite a bit about Bill Clinton. I thought it was particularly in the context of the ongoing Paula Jones lawsuit, it was rather shocking behavior by the president. It was rather reckless behavior by the president. And it had the potential to create great disruption to his presidency. On the other hand, I was very wary of Tripp and of becoming too enmeshed in what increasingly became clear. And I didn't know everything at the time. I only learned these things, over time. But her machinations involved to essentially entrapped the president were gave me a great deal of pause as well.
At what point did you think it's time to actually print something about Monica Lewinsky?
Not until I learned on a rather dramatic afternoon that Tripp had gone to Star, that Star had launched this secret criminal investigation of the president, that he had wired Tripp for a lunch with Lewinsky at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And at that point, there was no question in my mind that for an independent counsel to go to this extraordinary length of launching a secret criminal investigation of the president and wiring a woman in an effort to sting the president's alleged girlfriend, that was a quite monumental story. That would tell us as much about Ken Starr as it would about Bill Clinton. In fact, my initial reaction when I heard about Starr getting involved in this was, that's nuts, and that this was going to blow up in somebody's face, and whether it was going to be Bill Clinton or Ken Starr at that point, I didn't know. I thought it was as equally possible that it was going to blow up in Starr's face and discredit Starr as it would Clinton. I think at the end, it probably brought much discredit to both men, but at least that's how I initially perceived it.
My guest is Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff. His new book is called Uncovering Clinton. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Isikoff. He's written a new book about covering the presidential sex scandal called Uncovering Clinton. Would you describe the debate at Newsweek about whether to publish the Monica Lewinsky story when you thought it was time to go with it?
Yes, and it was quite dramatic because it took place on the same Saturday that Clinton was being deposed in the Paula Jones lawsuit and being asked questions about Monica Lewinsky, having no idea at that point that the allegations of his relationship with Lewinsky were known not just to Newsweek magazine, but to the independent counsel, Ken Starr, and that he was at that moment the subject of a criminal investigation into obstruction and subordination of perjury. At that point, we knew all this at Newsweek. We also knew that Starr had gone to the Justice Department and that Janet Reno had authorized an expanded mandate for Starr to conduct this investigation. Stripped of the sexual dimension, this would have been a no-brainer. It was at that point a matter of official record that Starr had received a expanded mandate to conduct this new criminal investigation of the president and had gone to this, you know, as I said, extraordinary length of conducting a sting of Lewinsky designed to gather evidence about the president. But it was, at its core, about a sexual relationship, and that made everybody uneasy, especially because it involved a woman, Monica Lewinsky, who at that point we didn't really know anything about. We had not had a chance to interview her. We had not had a chance to see her, to listen to her voice. Well, we had listened to her voice because we listened to the tapes the night before. But we were going to be taking a private figure, Monica Lewinsky, and thrusting her into the middle of a media maelstrom that would instantly erupt once this story became public. So there was a lot of agonizing about what to do about this. A number of us felt that the fact of the criminal investigation was made this story a compelling, newsworthy event that we had an obligation to tell our readers about. But there was this nagging fear among the editors that Lewinsky could well have made all this up, that she really didn't have anything like the relationship with the president that she had described to Linda Tripp, that Starr may discover that very quickly, and that we would go with a very big news story that about this criminal investigation hinged on the allegations of a sexual relationship, and it would quickly become clear that no such relationship existed. Now, in retrospect, that is obviously not what took place, but the editor's fear of going with a story that was going to blow up in Newsweek's face ultimately carried the day, and Newsweek did not publish the story that weekend.
Do you think that was the right decision?
No.
Why?
Because I think that, as I said, I argued very strongly, my colleague Danny Kleidman and ultimately assistant managing editor Evan Thomas all argued that the fact of the Star investigation was such an overwhelming news event that we had an obligation to report it.
What questions do you still have, if any, about the relationship of Kenneth Starr and his office with Linda Tripp?
Well, I think that Tripp misled everybody. She certainly misled Monica Lewinsky, for starters, but she misled Starr. The critical moment in this whole investigation, in this whole story, really comes down to Monday evening, January 12th, 1998. And this is a meeting that hasn't gotten much attention, but it's the night Jackie Bennett and several of his deputies go visit Linda Tripp in her home in Columbia, Maryland. And they, for the first time, hear in detail Tripp's allegations about Lewinsky and how Lewinsky had been pressuring her, Tripp, to lie under oath in the Paula Jones lawsuit. And Tripp says that she was so frightened by this and so disturbed by this that she was going to wire herself to gain new tape recordings of what she is describing to Starr's people as a federal crime or federal crimes. And Jackie Bennett stops her and says, you're not going to make any more recordings. If there's going to be recordings, we're going to do them. And that is really the moment that Starr's office becomes committed to conducting this investigation. And what is amazing when you look back in retrospect at that instant is how little Jackie Bennett and Starr's people knew about what they were getting into. Linda Tripp didn't tell Jackie Bennett and his aides that she had essentially arranged through the Paula Jones lawyers for the subpoena that she says, you know, she was so frightened of, that she had in effect set all this up. She didn't tell Jackie Bennett that she had been talking to Lucianne Goldberg, a New York literary agent who had been in touch with all the lawyers for Paula Jones. She didn't tell Jackie Bennett that she had been talking to me at Newsweek and that I knew about all of these claims. So when Bennett made the decision to have Starr get involved, he was really flying blind. Now, in his defense, he will say, and one can at least understand where he's coming from, he didn't know what Tripp wasn't telling him. On the other hand, I think it is probably legitimate to ask whether or not some more prudence and caution should have been taken by the people in Starr's office, and more questions should have been asked before they very quickly became involved in this, what turned out to be quite messy case.
What are the ethical questions relating to reporting that remain the most blurry to you now?
Well, I think the ones, and I talk about this in the epilogue in the book, is what is the relationship between reporters and sources with an agenda. It is quite common, and indeed it is essential to investigative reporting, to have sources who insist upon an anonymity, and you are obligated as a journalist to respect that. But in this case, and I think it is a case that has applicability to many different avenues of reporting, one can learn a lot more over time about one's sources. And what do you do when you discover your sources are misleading you or doing things that make you feel uncomfortable? And what do you do when the sources themselves become the story? We have, you know, very clear professional and ethical lines about protecting our sources, and indeed, you know, we in all spheres of life, in all spheres of reporting, go to extraordinary lengths to do that. But once you make those deals with sources, you're stuck with them and put in very awkward situations, as I was in the course of this, when I discovered that, you know, my sources, in this case Tripp and to a lesser extent Lucianne Goldberg, were very much responsible for the events I was seeking to cover. It's not an easy question, and anybody who thinks that there were easy answers here, I don't think has really thought through all the problems you can face.
Well, Michael Isikoff, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Isikoff's new book is called Uncovering Clinton. Monica Lewinsky will be our guest on Fresh Air Friday, April 23rd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.